The Future of Teamwork is a Leader production. Subscribe today and never miss an episode.
It feels like we're giving people scraps of lace instead of clothing, right? Yeah. Like it feels like, you know, folks are starving and we are giving them, you know, a really nice designer lollipop. That's nice and all. It's very pretty. I'm still going hungry.
Welcome to the Future of Teamwork podcast. My name is Dane Grunewald, and today I'm joined by Lily Zane. Lily has been doing some really cool work as a fair strategist and consultant at Zane Consulting, and as an author. Lily's most recent book, Fixing Fairness, great title. I'm excited to dive into that, but really talking about where we're going to actually nail the landing on building things that work for people, including our organizations, cultures, and products. So excited to dive into this today. Lily, thanks for being here on the show.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. Let's have a lot of fun. Let's hopefully, you know, cover a lot of ground, because I think these topics are really important and top of folks' mind right now.
Big time. And I love your safety moment pre-show when you were like, let's jump into the interesting, juicy stuff.
Yeah, because, you know, like people... people hear talking heads say the same talking points over and over and over again, right? So I'm very happy to kind of start from the same ground, right? To sort of ground people in how they might have heard people talk about fairness or diversity or inclusion before. But I'm hoping that throughout this conversation, we can get a little deeper and leave people feeling challenged, right? Enriched, maybe, you know, having some food for thought.
Brilliant, brilliant. So with that, Lily, tell us how you came to be doing this work, leading change in this field.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, I had the privilege about a decade ago to actually start my career doing diversity, equity, and inclusion training. It's not usually how most people in this field get their start, but, you know, imagine me fresh out of college, bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, going in and teaching people about these concepts of, you know, race 101, gender 101. How do we create a more welcoming environment for all of our colleagues? And I was very excited at the time, right? I was, you know, 20, 21. And almost immediately, right, I found that there was a bit of a disconnect, if you will, because I had gotten my education, I had gotten my master's degree in sociology, in organizational change. And so I was really excited to start changing culture, to start changing policies and practices, building workplaces that were better for people. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping that this work would connect to that, right? By understanding what makes us all different, hopefully we can build workplaces that are designed for all of us, that lift all of us up.
Yeah,
that's not what I found. That's actually not what I found in this work. I spent a lot of time hashing over the basics. You know, in every workshop, we would define race. We would talk about our stories. We would talk about our differences. We would talk about the existence of racism, right?
Yeah.
Of all of the harms in the world. You know, a big important starting point. We would get people really sober, thinking about the reality of the realities of our world and how it hasn't been working for people. And then we would leave them there, and then we would call it. And then that would be the workshop. We would say, like, racism exists. Racism is bad. Racism should make you feel bad. Stop that. Goodbye. We'll see you next week. And, you know, what I started realizing is that so much of this body of work, right, was built around what I call admiring the problem. And we spend so much time in this field talking about the problem, talking about how our workplaces are not designed for everyone, talking about how our policies are racist, our processes are sexist, right? The culture we're steeped in is full of ableism and transphobia and classism, right? Like all of the harms and ills of the status quo. We get people really anxious, really fearful, really sad. And then we leave. Right? We say, that's all bad. You need to stop doing that. We don't give people the solutions they're looking for. Or if we do, they're really shallow. We say, just try to be a better person. Try to be less racist. Take an unconscious bias training, right? If you just attend more of these workshops, maybe things will get better. We don't actually give people the tools to build better organizations. We don't give people the tools to build better communities. We don't give people the tools to be better colleagues, to be better parents, to be better community members, right? Yeah. What we do give them is anxiety and you know, some fear and grief and guilt, right?
Yeah.
And over the years, right, I started looking through the research of this field because I was thinking, you know, is this the best we can do? And I started finding, you know, a bunch of troubling data essentially saying that this approach of just trying to raise awareness, or worse, you know, blaming and shaming the people engaged in this learning might actually be backfiring. It might actually be lowering diversity. It might actually be driving backlash. It might actually be increasing discrimination. And so I started asking myself, is this the best we can do? Can we do better? And I kind of stumbled into a different way of doing this work. I'm certainly not the first practitioner to be having these thoughts, but I found myself joining, I think, a growing movement to make this field more rigorous, to really connect this field with organizational change management, to really make it feel more real, more people-centered, and more solutions-driven. And then the summer of 2020 happened, and everything exploded, right? I think most people remember, you know, those times as being the heyday of DEI, right? When every workplace was saying, like, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion, these are things that matter to us. We're going to make statements. We're going to post on social media. We're going to host events. We're going to hire practitioners. I actually remember that time very differently. It was a really rough time for me, because in the years before, I actually had a decent amount of success reaching those thoughtful leaders that wanted to do this work right. It wasn't hard to pick out the leaders that actually understood this work from the people that just wanted a gold star for doing the bare minimum.
Yeah.
In the summer of 2020, I want to say 90% of the people who reached out wanted a gold star to do the bare minimum. I was swamped with requests for the lowest quality work I can imagine, right? Like, Lily, come in for 30 minutes and fix racism. Lily, you know, like, come and talk to my folks for, you know, half an afternoon, and, you know, that'll change the entire culture of the company for good. And, you know, I think that summer really defined our field for the next couple of years, and frankly, for the worse. This idea of performative DEI, right, that people started talking about, like, it was baptized in the summer of 2020. That's when it really got real. And I've been trying to fix things since, right? Trying to actually get companies on the right track, trying to actually do this deeper, more intentional work of changing workplaces for the better and avoiding those shortcuts, right? Those flashy, those nice sounding platitudes that don't ultimately do anything. And of course, you know, in this political climate, it's even harder to do this work, but I think it's no less important and people are no less hungry for it.
Yeah, I love that. I love, there's so many great points that you just hit in that intro, Lily. Like, the whole here it is, you know, don't feel bad about it anymore. Like, telling people how they should feel isn't really doing anything, and then leaving. I love the fact that you so intentionally call out that we leave. Because going back to your point on gold stars, like, that is the experience a lot of people have lived. And I think, you know, to your point pre-show, it left the door wide open for people to bash the movement.
It did.
And now we've got to make it more about what you stated there. It's got to be more about what works for people, not just as employees, as team members, but as parents, as community members, like, what's driving our behaviors and our energy and how we live and how we work.
That's right. I really want to point out, right, that it's not the goals of this work that should be questioned. Like, we're all on the same boat. Like, we all deserve a better world. We all deserve a world free from discrimination. We all deserve a world where we have resources, where we're valued, where we're safe. Like, none of these things are up for debate. But man, you know, during our pre-conversation, we were talking about sticking the landing.
Yeah.
And sometimes, and maybe oftentimes, it feels like those who are most passionate about this work, we don't always stick the landing. We don't always leave people feeling more resourced, more supported, more safe, more valued. You know, we do a great job of shaking people out of the status quo, but we don't point them in a different direction. And yeah. So feeling unmoored, feeling unstable, as you brought up, that makes people prime targets for maybe less well-intentioned, more malicious actors to swoop in and say, they're the problem. The people trying to fix inequality, they're the problem.
Yeah.
Right? We need to blame them. And yeah. Unfortunately, right, like they are selling comfort. They're selling safety through fear, right? Through anxiety. And it's a very compelling message, unfortunately, because so many of us feel unmoored in our day-to-day. We feel, you know, pulled towards folks promising us safety.
Yeah.
And so if we are on the side of trying to make the world better, right, for all of us, not just some of us, I think we need to be thinking really critically about what people need, which is to feel challenged, but also safe, to feel supported at the same time, and to feel hopeful that it's not just that we're building a better world out of shame for the world that we live in. It's that we're building a better world out of hope for the world that might exist. And I think sometimes that message gets lost.
I think it does get lost. And I think it's fascinating the way you play with that word safety there, Lily, and that people gravitate towards it, even when it's not really safety. Like, for example, when we had that terrible plane crash in D.C., where we lost a lot of people, particularly that ice skating community was hit hard, and the president came out and blames it on DEIB. It's just, it's disgusting, right? It doesn't make any sense. There's no logic. And yet a group of people who felt fearful and anxious about how could we have a military helicopter fly into a commercial aircraft, what they flee to the safety of a statement that has no grounding, because they're like, well, at least someone's doing something. They're making a difference. They're changing how we work to create safety. To me, it made no sense. And I couldn't believe how many people got behind such a disgusting statement in such a painful time.
Yeah. I mean, the feelings behind it are real, even if the attributions might be completely nonsensical, right? Like, people are feeling, in these really hard moments, they're feeling grief. They're feeling destabilized. They're feeling confusion, right? Like, how could this have happened? And anything offering that certainty that resolves their grief, that gives them an outlet for their anger, I think feels really psychologically powerful. It feels really psychologically welcoming. It's what people need.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe in slightly better times, we could have had a president who used that time to bring people together. Maybe if there's something to be pointed at, right, we can say like, oh, this is why we need better safety regulation. This is why we need, you know, even more quality control. This is why we need, you know, all of these positive things that we've been pushing for a while. Let's use this moment of grieving, not to tear each other down, but to build something that will support us all.
Yes.
And that's not what we got, right? But the psychological principles are the same across both of these things, right? Like, people look for that safety. They gravitate towards what makes them feel welcomed, what makes them feel that sense of clarity and belonging and safety.
Yeah. Staying with that theme then, and coming back to fairness and actually making real organizational change, what I'm hearing is, if in our movement to create a more fair, more hopeful world where people can feel both safe and challenged in how they're participating, that we likely need to move away from celebrating certain holidays. We need to continue celebrating certain holidays and history of different people, but we need to make sure it's not only that. We need to move more into actual work that people can see and people can experience and live, and not sort of the frills of the movement.
Exactly, right? Like, it feels like, and you use the word frills, so let's play with it, right?
Yeah.
It feels like we're giving people scraps of lace instead of clothing, right? Yeah. Like, it feels like, you know, folks are starving and we are giving them, you know, a really nice designer lollipop.
Let them eat cake.
Right, you know, like that's nice and all. It's very pretty. I'm still going hungry. And I think the reality for people in our workplaces, I mean, just think about American workers, right?
Yeah.
Like, 91% of American workers have experienced workplace discrimination.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow, right?
Yeah,
like,
how
atrocious is that? And what are our workplaces doing about it? Let's do a Lunar New Year celebration. Let's, mm-hmm. you know, celebrate, I don't know, Cinco de Mayo, right? Like, let's do these little one-off events and give people a pat on the head, and then we're going to lay half of them off tomorrow.
Yeah.
Like, there's such a huge disconnect between the words we say and the investments we make and the actual reality of how we value people. And it's not the fault, right? Like, look, if you hire a practitioner in a workplace and you say your job is to fix discrimination in the workplace, your budget, I don't know, is $100 a month to put on an event. The most they can do is to put on a mediocre event. And guess what? That's exactly what we get, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's not their fault. No one can change, can fix discrimination with pennies, right? With no headcount.
Yeah.
If anything, they're being set up to fail. They're getting set up to be the fall guy for when people inevitably say, I'm being underpaid, I'm being discriminated against, you know, my colleagues are being laid off, we don't have good healthcare benefits, we're getting abused by our managers, and you're giving us a little Cultural Heritage Month celebration?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, you can screw off, right? Like this is not helping me.
Yeah.
And I think that's the reality that so many people find themselves in. They think about DEI, and honestly, what most people think of is just like, that's that ineffective training that no one's going to, or, you know, that's that email that I get that's kind of annoying that I just don't open. When what they should be thinking of is like, oh, this is people-centered work that helps my everyday at work feel a little more tolerable, right? Like, these are our workplace protections. These are the policies or the regulations that we've won through organized labor. These are mm-hmm. civil rights protections that ensure that I don't get discriminated against, right? That's the meat of it. And
yes.
we don't invest in the stuff that actually makes a difference. Instead, we just put pennies into this bread and circuses, right? This little song and a dance, this little frills celebration that signals our commitment, right? Well, it really virtue signals, without actually changing people's material reality.
Yeah. And material reality is a good one, Lily. And by the way, I love the design of Lollipop. We're going to get Alicia to build a really cool visual on the design of Lollipop. Unless you've already got one, and we'll post yours.
No, go for it. Go for it.
But it's super cool. That material reality is very much there. In the Lollipop analogy, it's the hunger. But hunger isn't solved with one meal. You know, even if we give them a nice meal.
That's right.
It's a daily, weekly, monthly, yearly, ongoing thing. And I think we need, even while we're in policy, apart from some of the frill type activities, isn't serving, because policies sit on shelves and get dusty, and the culture drives off, and the systems of work drive a lot of the lived experience,
it's
that material
behavior.
Reality. Yeah. Yeah. So, whether it's in the book Fixing Fairness or whether it's in your work right now, Lily, where are you finding an ability to go in and find those leaders who are willing to do the real work, like the 2-3-4 year getting into their systems, getting into their cultures, and looking at how we work, not just how we talk about, I love the way you said it, how we talk, admire the problem.
That's right. That's right. Well, so it's really interesting you bring this up, because I think leaders who have valued people, who mm-hmm. see people as assets, right, who invest in their people, they've been doing this work, whether or not they've been calling it DEI or FAIR or, you know, inclusion and belonging, for years and years and years. And I've met, you know, I've had the good fortune to meet dozens of these leaders. And the way they talk about things, it's very different than how you hear folks talking about DEI. They will say things like, hey, you know, my team members are brilliant and I'm here to support them as a leader to do their best work. That's it, right? Like, they'll say very simple things. And when you dig into their practices, they will say things like, oh yeah, you know, of course I invest in, you know, these really good ways to track impact. Of course, you know, I connect my team members with each other to make sure that they understand the needs of the organization. Oh yeah, you know, of course I talk to them regularly. We have one-on-ones. We troubleshoot whatever needs they have. We solve problems for them. You know, like, oh yeah, you know, sometimes we engage in conflict. We disagree. And we have really good conversations among the team because sometimes it's not cut and dried, right? Sometimes it's not black and white. We make good decisions around how we do this work. And you listen to them describe it as matter of fact. And you just have to, like, take a step back and be like, you have just described, random leader, right? Like, what every single DEI practitioner would see as their, like, dream scenario, right? Like, you're taking into account difference. You're doing systems design. You're changing policy and practice. You've built the psychological safety to have actual productive conflict in your workplace. Like, how do we get 100 of you?
Yeah.
But the fascinating thing is leaders like this, they might not even know how to define DEI, the terms, right? Like, they're simply thinking, look, my people are valuable. And the way I get more value from my people is by equipping them with more, right? By supporting them, by creating an environment that's helpful for them. And since all my people are different, I can't just use a one-size-fits-all because that would be lazy leadership. I need to actually push myself as a leader to design an environment that works for everybody. So whether my team is remote, whether my team is hybrid, whether my team doesn't all speak English as a first language, whether some of my team members are parents, whether some of my team members are different generations.
Yeah.
I'm not taking a training to learn all of these things. I'm just saying, wow, you know, my team members are all different, so I better get to know them and make sure that I design a workplace for them. They make it seem so easy, right? And like, that's what we're trying to teach everybody to do. We've just chosen really weird roundabout ways to do it that I don't think are particularly landing. So in my work, right, like I find these leaders and I help them understand that this work is not about the words or the acronyms or the trainings. It's about seeing the value of people and recognizing that your job as a leader is to meet your people where they're at, to support them, not to do more with less, because I think there's this big trend right now of trying to exploit our people to the maximum, but to instead help our people do more with more, right? Mm. To be that resource that our people need to do their best work and then to reap all the benefits that come from a fully engaged workforce, right? Like, what was that research that just came out? It was something like 30% or less of American workers are engaged at work. It's dismal. It's like the worst numbers we've seen in decades.
Ever.
And it's not a surprise because our leaders are treating people like, you know, they're cows for the slaughter, right? Like they're not actually taking care of their people. And so workers are absolutely not rewarding their workplaces with anything but the bare minimum. Are we surprised, right? Is this the best we can build? I don't think so, right? We just have to be willing to do different ourselves as leaders and practitioners.
Yeah, I love that. I particularly love more with more, Lily. It's it goes against the grain. It actually ties in really well to the work we've been doing around healthy teams, which we've been, going back to some of the early comments, defining as a team where, yes, you get the job done, but you're sending your people home happy, balanced, energized. Happy is maybe a strong word. Balanced and energized to be able to contribute in their other roles in the community. And I think more is important, whether that's more Slack, whether that's more flexibility, but I think it does start with more. So I'm fascinated to hear maybe a little bit more of some examples where you've been working with one of these leaders and what you've defined as the more, that, you know, as a gift that is shared in the colleagues amongst the community to drive some of these better behaviors, better culture.
Oh yeah. So easy one. You can look at the research on how many hours of work a week line up with productivity. Like, you know, the productivity research is really, really interesting. Now, most people in their heads, they just imagine that the more hours a week you work, the more productive you are. That's kind of the layperson's logic, right? If I work 10 hours, I'm a little productive. If I work 20 or 30, I'm even more productive. If I work 40 or 50, I'm even more productive. And if I'm this magical startup wizard, right, I work 60 to 80 hours and I'm this font of productivity and like no one can beat me and, you know, I'm the most productive person in the world. Research completely disagrees, right? And if anyone's ever pulled an all-nighter, I think you would know that you do not do your best work on no hours of sleep at 5 in the morning after drinking your third coffee or Red Bull, right? Like you're delusional, right? Like you're unhinged. You're not connected to reality. You might feel productive, but you're like churning out nonsense at that point. And what the research shows time and time again, whether we look at like a 4-hour work week or whether we, sorry, 4-hour, I wish, a 4-day work week, or, you know, how many, so what is it? I think it's 30 hours a week that corresponds with maximum productivity, and productivity falls off sharply after that. And after 50, it basically turns into a cliff. So like pretty much no hours
there's
of work.
There's no marginal
after,
benefit.
There's no benefit. Like you're literally just making slop at that point. Yeah. Because the hits to your well-being, to your productivity, to the quality of your work just goes rapidly downhill. I think this is a lesson for our people, right? Like there was just some research that came out in the Harvard Business Review talking about how everyone is using, right, like these new productivity tools, whether we ask, you know, Claude or ChatGPT, right? To be more productive. And we're finding that these tools don't actually make us more productive. They actually make us more stressed out because we're just working all the time now and the actual quality of our work is not necessarily improving.
Yeah.
So, you know, one example, right, is teaching workplaces and managers to decouple this idea of productivity from this idea of busyness. And so many of our workplaces are afflicted with this, right? Like, The only way we can measure work is by seeing butts in seats, by hearing people typing, by hearing people clicking, and we have no way to actually measure the quality of their inputs. And so if you were to put in front of me, you know, hey, Lily, you know, I asked this person who really knows what they're doing. They thought really hard for 30 minutes, and then they took 20 minutes to write, you know, this write-up. Is it good versus... Wow, Lily, this person spent 9 hours generating things on ChatGPT. Is it good? Most people would say like, oh, yeah, the 9-hour guy,
give
right?
It to
like,
me. Yeah,
like
yeah.
He put 9 hours into it. Like, this thing must be really good. Mm-mm. That's not how it works, right? Like, quality always beats quantity. And most of our workplaces are completely misincentivized to have people doing nothing, right? For hours and hours and hours. And lots of us have been in these jobs ourselves doing this, right? We're like, look, I could get the job done in 1 hour, but then my manager would give me more work. So what am I going to do? I'm going to waste time for the entire day and then give them what they want at the end of the day and be like, oh, I worked the whole day on it. And our manager's going to be like, yeah, good job, right? Really, really hustling. Whereas our colleague who has no idea what they're doing, they could spend 5 days, right, completely walking into a wall, right, and then give the manager something even worse at the end, and the manager will say like, yeah, you spent 5 days really, you know, like racking your brain for it, nice work, man. We all know workplaces like this, right? Lots of us have worked in them ourselves. So, you know, first step, decouple the actual quality of the output from all the busy work or the appearance of productivity that we've been taught to put in. Right.
Yeah.
And if we can do that, that's a huge if. But if we can do that, that creates a radically different workplace. It creates a workplace where the quality of our ideas, the impact of our work matters far more than the appearance of productivity.
Yes.
If we can create massive change, right, or huge impact with 20 minutes of work because we took the time to spend a few hours of time just thinking about it or connecting with people, that should be praised far more than someone that spends 2 weeks doing nothing.
Love it.
That should be rewarded more. That should be promoted, right?
Yeah.
That should be celebrated. Now, how many of us have the luxury to work in a workplace like that? I would say close to none of us, right?
And it goes back to the importance of the role of the leader, going back to your earlier point, because HR's not going to change that.
No.
The head of sales isn't going to change that. It really needs
to come from a CEO. Well, the head of sales could change that if you work for sales.
Yeah, maybe in their team, you're right. But culturally across an organization, that decoupling, I think it's the role of the CEO or the top executive in that team to hold firm behind that. And it's a scary place to stand when you've got shareholders and metrics and everything else, because often even when you know change is going to bring value over time if you have any degree of uncertainty of, like, is there a J curve we're going into, that won't prevent you from taking that bold step forward.
But it's so funny that you're saying this, because, like, we say the word metrics, right? Like, somehow metrics will prevent us from making this really smart decision.
Yeah.
It's the complete opposite, right? If we actually collected real metrics on productivity and performance, we would know that, you know, this arbitrary BS about people doing their best work when they just, you know, sit at their desk for 50, 60 plus hours doing nothing. Like, we would know that that's false. And instead, we disregard all the metrics we have to just rely on our vibes and our gut feeling of busier means better.
That's a good challenge.
Like, I recall all the stories about, I think it was Tesla, right? One of Musk's companies, where his engineers would say, yeah, as soon as he walked into the room, I would switch screens over to this, you know, auto-playing terminal that would just write lines of code because he liked it, right? It just looked like I was busy with doing things. And, like, he loved that, right? So many of us have done the equivalent where, you know, we'll just be like, oh, God, you know, like, it doesn't even matter if I'm productive. Like, leaders just want to see me looking busy.
Yeah.
So here I am going to put, you know, my silly little scrolling thing of code that makes it look like I'm working.
That's
like,
awesome.
We have all of these rituals, these nonsense rituals that have no bearing whatsoever on actual productivity or performance or impact. And we elevate them above all of the actual real metrics and then tell ourselves this false story that, oh, it's what the shareholders want. The shareholders couldn't care less, right?
Correct.
Like, the only thing that shareholders care about is they want number go up. Like, you know, they want the stock value to go up. They want you to hit your revenue targets. Maybe you could hit your revenue targets a little better if everyone wasn't sleep deprived from working 90 hours a week.
Yeah.
You know,
have
you thought of that, manager? But we're just so married to our old ways of working, right? And they're dragging all of us down.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And real metrics, I'm a bit of double pick on that. I've spent a bit more time researching it too. It's funny, it reminds me of a story in COVID. One of my former employers was so afraid of remote work, having been always in office, that they engaged the technology that determined whether your screen was on and, like, your keystrokes. So people were, like, leaving things propped on their keyboard when they go out to walk their dog that was just, like, hitting keys and keeping the screen open, which goes totally against the grain, because now you're actually creating incentives for your team members to be measured as busy and do no work.
Exactly, right? Like, that's such a perfect example. And the reason why, you know, like, these kinds of unhelpful behaviors happen is not because there's any data or metrics that mass surveillance of your employees makes them more productive. It's because the completely, you know, non-data-backed decision of one leader having anxiety and maybe needing to talk to a therapist is influencing their entire company's people policy, lowering everybody's productivity, increasing everybody's anxiety, lowering everyone's well-being. For what, right? Someone that can't let go of their command and control, and someone who has trust issues and can't trust your employees to do their best work, man, like, what a tragedy, right? This isn't how we should be imagining our workplaces.
And Lily, I love that you tied into the anxiety. I'm going to throw a gender question at you, which may not be appropriate, but let's go for it. A therapist I work with shares a very firmly held belief that men, and I know we have more than one gender, but in her words, men, when they're anxious, go to action. So your example of the manager who has lost their command and control, they start throwing a whole bunch of stupid actions that don't tie to the work because actions make them feel better in anxiety. Women go towards connection rather than action to serve their anxiety, right, wrong, or otherwise. Like, where do you see that show up and what's missing in those statements? Because I hear it more and more right now in terms
that's
of
so interesting.
The leaders.
Okay. So I don't think that that's necessarily wrong, but I think the way we're understanding it might not be complete. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to start from a universal statement. People look for methods to resolve their anxiety. I think this is just universally true. Nobody likes anxiety. When we feel anxious, we want to get rid of it, right? So that's statement one. Statement two, there are gender-related, socially acceptable ways to resolve anxiety. So depending on our gender, right, we might be celebrated or punished or normalized for resolving our anxiety in certain ways.
Yes.
Right? So, you know, for example, if a guy feels anxious, right, and he says, I don't know, I was feeling antsy, so I went to the shooting range. Yeah, you know, I think we'd be like, okay, that's fair, right? And then if he said instead, oh, yeah, you know, I felt anxious, so I called up a bunch of my friends and we talked on the phone for 3 hours. I think we'd be like, you should have gone to the shooting range, buddy, right? It's not that men act a certain way because they're men. It's because we have these very odd prescriptive boxes around, you know, good or bad ways to deal with our emotions. And I'm just going to go out there and say the acceptable ways that we prescribe for men versus women on how to deal with your emotions are much more limited for men.
Yeah.
You know, like if a woman was anxious and also went to the shooting range, I think a good chunk of us would be like, hell yeah, girl power, right? But I think we don't do a good enough job extending, you know, making that box bigger for men, saying like, look, there's tons of ways to resolve your anxiety. You should call your dad. You should call your mom. You should talk about your feelings for a few hours. Right? Yeah. Like you should get some support. You should talk to your therapist. These are very real things that are effective for people of all genders. And yet, you know, we have these very narrow prescriptions for gender. So that's my take.
Great answer. And I particularly like the socially acceptable ways, gender related rather than scientifically wired. And I also think that potentially narrowing of the aperture of opportunity for male leaders, which we have an abundance of,
absolutely
is a big problem. That actually leads me to a second question for you, maybe another curveball. The role of HR, like we talked a lot about the role of a leader. I do a lot of work with brilliant HR professionals all over the world. And yet at times I find that HR gets in the way, not intentionally, but HR is... Let me create a very simple illustration. You can play with that. HR is operating from a place of good intent, an organization of people, yet they have these tools that are heavily individualized around how we hire, performance manage, reward, allocate tasks to individual people, where I think work gets done in teams and is far more fluid than the systems and tooling allows for.
Interesting.
And therefore, when a leader wants to come in and make changes, often the existing systems are the very obstacles preventing some of that meaningful organizational change. With that in mind, if you're bringing a fixing fairness mindset to an organization, you know, how do you leverage HR and the existing kind of systems, technical, you know, dependencies or debt to move forwards?
Okay, I like this question. I'm going to answer it in a roundabout way, and I promise that this answer will actually get to what you're asking. I'm going to tell you a bit of a story about HR, right?
Yeah.
So imagine the beginning of the HR field when HR didn't even exist. In the very beginning, HR was just a way for managers and leaders to outsource decisions around hiring, for, you know, per se, right? Like payroll. HR was just hiring usually one person at the very start to own these kinds of systems that were distributed across the organization, but that everyone needed to do. Mm-hmm. So it was much better to hire one person to deal with all the hiring across the organization than to try to train every single manager to do their own hiring. Yeah. That was the logic, right? Now, at the time, HR had a very critical challenge, which was how do we create a standardized system across the entire workplace if I'm just one person sitting in a function over here and I don't get to see the day-to-day work? And so the origins of HR, you know, started in building these systems to say, hey, you know, I'm going to create a rule that no matter what department you're in, whether you're sales or marketing or engineering, you've got to follow these hiring rules, right? You've got to follow these rules for promotion or for termination or discipline, just for consistency across the workplace. No one likes this. Like, no one likes any constraints on their work. But it is essential to have that consistency, right? So that we can ensure that people are, let's say, treated fairly across the organization, and that one bad boss, right, can't just completely derail their entire arm of the organization just because they hold all the tools. So HR was the standardizing force. Now, HR being its own function also means that it takes a lot of work to create one of these policies. So once they create it, they're quite incentivized to hold on to it, to say like, okay, this is ours now. This is in our little fiefdom, right? So we're going to cling on to this. We're going to, you know, hold it close to our chest, and we're going to try to create more policy, more process, more systems. Over time, in very mature, you know, workplaces, you see HR having this huge bureaucratic arm, right? Saying like, oh, now we own hiring, promotion, termination, feedback, discipline, performance improvement plans, succession planning even, and now we're doing people and culture. All of this is ours. I think the kind of bloat that can happen is when HR loses track, right? It forgets that their job is to be a steward of their workplace's people rather than to be a steward of their workplace's policies.
Yeah.
And when their policies drift, they no longer serve people. HR has, I would say, a responsibility to change those policies, to evolve their processes, to serve their people. Not every HR manager does this. Some HR managers say, look, this policy that we developed 30 years ago, this is the law. These are the rules. I'm a police officer now, right? If you don't follow the rules, you're the problem. Instead of saying, do the rules need to change? How have, you know, the needs of our people changed? What might the best rules and policies and processes be that might maximally empower our people? How might the status quo change? And I see a huge difference between HR leaders that can recognize this and see their systems, right, as a means to an end, versus those HR leaders that see the system as the end-all be-all and try to mold people into it.
Yeah.
And I think we need way, way, way more HR leaders that are willing to let their systems evolve, and also to let go of this need to see yourself as a cop, right? Like, like, I think we have this really weird situation where individual HR leaders, they're all very nice people. I don't think I've ever met like a vicious, mean HR leader. But sometimes they can say completely unhinged things when they say like, oh yeah, this policy causes massive harm to tons of people. And those are the rules, honey, right? Like, I know I care a lot about you as a person, but I can't do anything about this horribly toxic, you know, unhinged policy that hurts lots and lots of people. You just have to deal with it.
Yeah.
Like,
no, I think that story
is so toxic. It's so toxic.
And they're trapped. And I think what's interesting on the trap, and it goes back to the top of your story where the leader delegated to an individual to start HR. One of my mentors says, when the Industrial Revolution came on, people went from managing people to managing machines, technology, mills, and they were way more excited about the science than the people. So a lot of our leaders of organizations stopped thinking about the people and therefore required HR to just make it compliant and make it work. So I think while HR has a role to play in giving up the cop title, I think you need the leader to move from a place of abdication where they just said HR deals with it to delegation where they're still responsible.
Fully agree. So this is the exact same conversation that we have with, surprise, surprise, DEI. Right? Yeah. Like lots of workplaces said, oh, you know, diversity, equity, inclusion, we care about these things. What we're going to do is we're going to delegate the entire function to one under-resourced chief DEI officer, or maybe we'll just put them under HR. And you actually see, you know, represented in research, this exact thing that you're talking about. When you delegate away this work, individual leaders actually become more discriminatory, more exclusionary, less respectful.
Yeah.
Because they've kind of mentally offloaded the responsibility of being a good person, because now they're like, oh, good thing there's a cop over there. That's their job, right?
Yeah.
They can catch me when I'm doing something wrong, so I don't have to think about it anymore.
Yeah.
And I think this is the completely opposite way to go about this work. We need to be teaching leaders not only that they have to take more responsibility, right, but that there is a joy in supporting our team members like this. There is mutual benefit to taking on that responsibility and to empower ourselves to say, look, as leaders, you know, not only are you responsible for your team, you know, when you help your team win, that actually helps you win more. Like, why would you delegate that? Why would you put the responsibility of being a good person onto someone else who you barely know? That's not going to change your behavior. And in fact, that's you abdicating responsibility to be the leader that your team members need. There have been so many debates over the years of like where in the organization DEI should sit, right? And I think, you know, truly the way this work is evolving is that DEI should sit in the competency set of every single leader, just as the understanding that, like the leader I talked about in the beginning of this conversation, you know, if you recognize the inherent differences among every member of your team, but have the chops to bring them together and to create an environment where they can thrive, you are just a better leader, period. Right?
Yeah.
Like you doing that makes you just quantitatively and measurably a better leader than people who cannot do that. And you should aspire to be like that, right? Like that, I think, is the evolution of this work, pushing the rank and file leaders, right? Like every leader to develop that competency themselves.
Well, I love the every leader competency. I mean, that's really strong, Lily. At the same time, and I guess the closing question is, and I love fairness, is there an argument that DEIB is only a part of the fairness continuum, and therefore maybe in the future businesses need to have someone who's more in like the new CFO, the chief fairness officer, from a systems and from a complexity and levels of work standpoint, not just people and discrimination, but like how work gets done.
Interesting. I could see it honestly being an operations role, because when you do look at fairness, right, you look at the way systems are designed, usually people processes. So things like how people are paid, how people are promoted, how people are disciplined, how people are terminated, how you make decisions across the organization. And so ideally, this role should be able to collect a lot of people-related data, right, to collect demographics, to look at things like are women being promoted as quickly as men, or are, you know, queer and trans people being terminated at the same rate as straight people? Like, we should be able to collect this data and to say, like, hey, are there any major disparities that might clue us in to potential discriminatory behaviors, or even, you know, lots of well-intentioned people that might be upholding, right, like default norms or processes that might be discriminatory in their impact. So either way, regardless of what we call this role or where we situate it, we do need to have the ability to process all this people data. I actually think HR is a pretty good fit for it, if you ask me, because I think HR already stewards these systems. So maybe I'm going to say something controversial and say, like, I don't think the problem is that DEI lives in HR. I think the problem is that HR itself has never been empowered to be a change management role. It's always been a police officer role.
Yeah.
And so HR has had very little power to actually shift the systems that they steward. They only have the power to enforce. And when they're enforcing something toxic, rather than people correctly labeling that it's the executives that made those toxic policies that are at fault, they say, like, oh, HR as the cops, right? Like, it's their fault for enforcing a toxic policy.
Yeah.
I think we need to be reimagining all people work in general to treat this function not as a passive one that enforces policy, but as an active one that evolves these kinds of systems to meet the needs of their people. So whether we call this HR, whether we rebrand it as fairness, whether it's DEI, I think, like, this is where the field needs to evolve to stay relevant. And I think this is relevant to all HR right now as well, because I think we're at an inflection point among all of HR, where we can see the push led by companies like Sherm, for example, towards compliance, towards like, oh, let's lean hard into being cops. And then this other alternative saying like, well, maybe we need to reimagine the whole function. What might that look like? That's what I'm interested in, right? Yeah. Like, I don't think there's anything to be gained about rolling back the clock and trying to go back to how, you know, this work looked like in the 80s or in the 90s. I think we need to be designing HR for 2050. And that requires that we look differently at the things that might have served us up until this point.
Yeah, I love that beat, Lily, and I think it's critical. I also will challenge leaders to be thinking, and we've seen some firms rolling a lot of people change people metrics under digital transformation now. So I'd be challenging leaders to be thinking not only about the people they serve as employees, but as we see more dynamic teaming, as we see more impact of products and services in the community, what are the other people you serve? You know, are they customers? Are they suppliers?
Right.
You know, are they independent contractors? Are they adjacent, adjacent competitors that are in the same sort of field? I think that's going to be really interesting because there's going to be, with all of the AI, with the social change we're living through, just a phenomenal pace of change. So designing systems in a vacuum, just thinking about your employees is probably going to leave you a little bit behind the eight ball.
Man, you know, talking about AI, right? Like this, I think, yes, we are at a phenomenal pace of change right now. But that's a choice that leaders are making. And we do find ourselves in an era where the tools are more disruptive than they ever have been. But I don't think that means that we necessarily need to be flipping everything on our table upside down.
Yeah.
And I see these new tools that we're adopting basically as force multipliers for the status quo, right? Like now, whatever people were doing before these tools, they can do 10 times more of that. So if they were creating slop, if they were creating low quality work, if they were overworking, if they were toxic, well, good news. Now they can be toxic and overworked 10 times more than they were yesterday, you know, with our handy new, you know, large language models. So it still rests on the leader to make good decisions around how we roll out these tools in our workplaces. And frankly, if you ask me, there's way too little consideration about the actual impact of these new tools we're using, right? Yeah. Not just on our people or on our workforce or on our work, but on our customers, our consumers. It feels to me like hype is driving so much of these processes that we are intentionally leaving people behind, that the idea that people are valuable is being snuffed out in favor of full speed ahead, maximum exploitation. We're going to leave as many people behind as possible, burn it all to the ground, and hopefully some people will still be left afterwards to buy our product. And it doesn't seem like smart business leadership to me, I gotta say, right?
Yeah.
Jumping on the bandwagon is not always a smart choice to make. And I think the actual, you know, people-centered leaders right now are being thoughtful and saying, what problems does this allow us to solve? Where, you know, can we benefit from not, right, like investing in these kinds of solutions? Where is it still important for people to be managing their own decisions or work products? And I wish we had more of that conversation with AI, right? Like we're not breaching those topics enough. And we could spend an entire hour talking just about that, I feel
we
like.
Should. But we should come back and do that again. Billy.
Yeah, invite me back.
No, I'd love to have you back. I really enjoyed the conversation from like the here it is, you know, don't feel bad and leaving people and some of the backlash, some of the pain that we've had, the virtue signaling into the more optimistic and hopeful approach to building healthier teams, looking at org change, making it about how we do the work so we can support more people to do their best work. I love the role of the leader. More with more is probably my favorite soundbite from today. But I didn't forget the designer lollipop either. And as we got into things like the real metrics and acceptable ways of dealing with emotions, I thought that really powerful content there for us all to be thinking about as leaders. And then finally, you know, role of HR and where does fairness sit and who are we serving at large with our systems design? There's so much gold in there, Lily. I appreciate your viewpoints. And if any of our listeners want to find you or Fixing Fairness or any of your work, I know you're prolific on LinkedIn. Where do they go?
Yeah, well, you can follow me on LinkedIn, like you said. I post too often. You can also learn more about my business and the work that I do at lilyzhang.co. And you can buy Fixing Fairness wherever books are sold. So Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Bookshop, if you want to support your local independent bookstore. Yeah, just get involved and learn about this work, because I think the future is people-centered, if you ask me, right? Yeah. And we could use a little more guidance with the world upside down and on fire on how it is we actually build better for our people and design better for all of us, right? Because we need that.
Love it. Well, Lily, thanks for running over with me today. It's been awesome, and we'll do a second episode soon.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Just a quick note before we go. The views and opinions shared in this episode are those of our guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the host, Dane Gruneveld, the Leader Group, our patron Huddle 3, or our partners and affiliates. Any scenarios discussed are for the purpose of fueling creative thinking and conversation, and should be viewed only in this context. Dane, Leader, our sponsors, partners, and affiliates do not endorse any guest or any organization they may be associated with. It's important to remember that every workplace is as individual as the people within it. Our recommendation is to always seek solutions that are specifically designed to help serve your team's unique needs. And to this point, please know we're here, ready to help you find the best way forward, no matter where your starting point is. You can connect with Dane or myself, Alicia McCraw, on LinkedIn or via the links contained in the show notes. Thanks again for tuning in. And hey, if you think someone in your network would benefit from this episode, feel free to share it or give us a 5-star rating. Those 5 little stars really help us reach more curious people like you. We'll catch you next time on The Future of Teamwork.